You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, as President Trump holds a rally in Duluth tonight, we're examining whether he's remaking the Republican Party in his own image. There's some evidence for it. Tennessee Republican Bob Corker recently called out his fellow Republicans for being unwilling to buck the president on a tariff amendment.
We might poke the bear. The president might get upset with us as United States senators if we vote on the Corker Amendment. So we're going to do everything we can to block it.
Indeed, Senator Corker, who is retiring, added, "We're in a strange place. It's becoming a cultish thing, isn't it?" Is it? Mark Sanford and some of the other congressional incumbents who have criticized Trump and lost their primaries might agree. But if the GOP is Trump and Trump is the GOP, what does that mean for the present and the future of the party? And how does that sound to Republican voters? And this is where you come in on a day when the president is going to be in Minnesota. If you vote Republican or independent, whether you supported Trump as a candidate or not, how comfortable are you with the idea that President Trump is both the standard bearer and the soul of the Republican Party? And Democrats, does that provide opportunity or risk for your party? So I want to hear from you if you're a Republican and independent, especially some young Republicans out there, about how comfortable you are with the idea that the president basically owns the Republican Party. He is the party and the party is Trump. How does that feel? And Democrats, what about the opportunity you think that provides to you, especially in a state where that did not go with President Trump in 2016, but that had a lot of votes for the president? It's a good place to have the conversation. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Russell Berman is with us. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and we find him today in McAllen, Texas. Russell, I understand you're covering these border and immigration issues there. I'm glad you had time for us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Carnahan is with us. She's chair of the Minnesota GOP. She is already up in Duluth. And Jennifer, I appreciate the time. I know we have to cut this a little short, but thanks for the time this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me as well.
I'm interested, Jennifer. I know you've heard that there are some Republican politicians in Minnesota, Tim Pawlenty among them, who are wrestling with whether they want to be seen on stage with President Trump. Is that an indication, just one indication, of this push-pull of the idea that President Trump represents the Republican Party?
Well, President Trump, since he was elected, has been doing an incredible job for our country and moving America forward in a positive way over a number of different areas.
Jennifer, can you specifically address the question I asked you and not just give me some kind of talking point here? I'm asking you about whether there are Republican politicians who are torn about whether to be on stage with President Trump and whether that's an indication of the question that I'm asking in the show. What's your take on it?
Well, a couple of things. I can't speak for any other Republican politician because each Republican politician makes their own decisions about their issues and values and where they stand. So I wouldn't feel comfortable speaking on behalf of anybody else. As far as it relates to being a part of this rally and being on stage, it's not an individual politician or candidate's decision to be on this stage. This is a rally for President Trump. This is a rally to promote and talk about the positivity of our opportunities in Congressional District 8, and our Republican-endorsed candidate, Pete Stauber, will be a part of that. So this rally is really to bring the energy and enthusiasm. So it isn't about who wants to or doesn't want to be on stage with President Trump or where an individual politician stands. It's really about celebrating our opportunities and the energy and excitement that the president brings to Minnesotans.
Jennifer, do you agree with this idea that we're going to discuss through the hour that the Republican Party is now Donald Trump and Donald Trump is the Republican Party? And are you comfortable with that?
I don't agree to say that an entire party is based on one person.
Okay.
The Republican Party has been around for a long time, just as the Democrat Party has, right? a party is made up of, you know, thousands, millions of unique individual people with their unique individual thoughts and values and ideas. And what binds us together as a party is that we share more commonalities about things and where we see the direction that the country should head. And President Trump represents a lot of those values and speaks on a level that energizes people all around the country.
Russell, is that where you think the debate is? And I noticed Jennifer used the word values. Is that kind of the essence of the debate, particularly when we're in the midst of this controversy around immigration?
Yes, I think it is. It's also about rhetoric. You hear from a lot of Republicans who try to sort of separate the policies that the president has been pursuing from his style and his rhetoric and maybe even his values. But, you know, they may be less comfortable with the way that he's going about it, with the sort of the insults and the tweets and all of that. But more and more you're seeing Republicans who are actually supporting the policies of the president. I think obviously this border separation is an exception to that. Mm. That's, I think, part of what you're seeing with this rallying around and the Republican Party really becoming the party of Trump, as you say.
One last question here, Russell, because we're talking about some individual policies here. What about when it comes to trade and what Corker was saying? There are a number of Republicans, Ben Sasse among them, out of Nebraska, who are worried about what this trade policy is going to mean for them. But Corker is right, isn't he, that there isn't a lot of serious pushback against the president on it. What does that say?
It says a lot. I mean, think about this. With the Republican Party for the last couple of decades, at least, has been the party of free trade in this country, and it would be unthinkable, even just maybe 2 years ago, to see the Republicans elect a president who was essentially anti-free trade, who was pro-tariff, and for them not to really do anything about it. Yes, you have senators like Senator Corker, Senator Sasse, who are speaking out against it, but then you have the Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has no interest in moving the legislation that they would want, which would assert Congress's role under the Constitution in trade policy. So it's pretty extraordinary the movement that we've seen on this particular issue in the Republican Party, given that, you know, just a couple of years ago they were diametrically opposed to what the president is pursuing.
Jennifer, I'm going to take two calls here from young Republicans back to back for you. So let's go to Matt in Stillwater first. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. You're in your early 30s, is that right?
Yeah, 32.
How are you thinking about how the president is or isn't reshaping the GOP party?
Well, certain policies I adamantly disagree with. This policy with tariffs, I think, is outrageous. We're all invested in the stock market, whether you're Democrat, Republican, whatever, work. And the stock market doesn't know what to do with this guy. Second thing, I have kids. And in terms of you know, a president is somewhat of a role model. I'm not saying Bill Clinton was either, but Donald Trump is probably the worst in that regard, how he carries himself. And he seems to cozy up to dictators, and that really bothers me, too. So
okay. Let me go to John in Maple Grove. John, you're also a young Republican. Sounds like you have a different view. What's your thought?
I agree with the previous caller, Matt, that President Trump says some stupid things, and he's a bit of a crass individual, obviously. But I see him doing more things that I agree with than any recent Republican candidates or Republican presidents. The tariffs, I would agree that, yes, I'm more of a free trade by, you know, philosophy. But I do see that the countries that he tariffs is simply saying, hey, you're doing this to us, so I'm going to do it back to you. And that kind of sums up Trump's entire philosophy, is you hit me, I'll hit back.
Okay. So, Jennifer, you've heard the views from two youngish Republicans there. What do you take from that?
You know, every individual is entitled to, you know, as I talked about before, feel how they feel about certain issues and different things like that. I mean, certainly as a party, I don't think that people always agree on 100% of issues. I think that's very hard to do. I mean, you don't even agree with your spouse on 100% of issues, right? And that's what makes our country so unique and special, is that we all can have respectful debate and disagreement on issues. But as it relates to the president and what he's doing related to tariffs, you know, from my perspective, I think he's standing up for the country and is saying that we're not going to get ripped off anymore with bad trade deals. And he's trying to do things to put America first. We will see what the impact is over time. You know, you have to let some of these things play out and see how it does impact our economy positively, which is the intent, I think, behind this.
Yeah, this is a good point, Russell, that I wanted to come around to. I'm glad Jennifer's brought it up about economic times. We're in a strong economy. The job prospects look good for many Americans. Everything else seems to, yes, we have our daily controversies, but when the economy is good, does support solidify behind a president who, again, is the standard bearer of the party?
I think that's right. I mean, historically, presidents do well when there is a good economy, whether or not their specific policies had much to do with it. And, you know, obviously that's going to be a debate for not only 2018, but certainly 2020, if the economy continues to be strong as it is right now. But yeah, I mean, Trump is benefiting clearly, at least among Republican voters, from the fact that the unemployment rate is so low and that job prospects are much better than they were in previous years.
A call here from Nancy in Bemidji. Hi, Nancy. What did you want to ask about?
Well, I just wanted to make a comment that I just find that the standard bearer of the Republican Party is Trump. I just think it's an appalling, awful standard that he's brought the Republican Party to. I voted Republican for many, many years, but this man is just so, to me, immoral and crass, and the things that comes out of his mouth. One time he says one thing, the next time he says something completely opposite, and I just find it difficult that rational people can continue to support him.
Jennifer, I want to ask you something that privately, and I think we talked about this last time you were on the show. Do you wish that Republican voters did not have to make the trade-off that we just heard Nancy wrestling with, that I think we see in other Republican voters, which is, I want to support his policies. He makes it hard to give him my wholehearted support because of the kind of persona he is. I mean, be candid with me about whether, you know, you hear that, the trade-off situation from voters.
You know, I don't, this is being completely honest, I don't regularly hear that when I go out and talk to Republicans around the state of Minnesota. Where we tend to hear that from is people that, you know, perhaps were not, you know, strong, consistent, you know, reliable Republicans all the time, or people that have maybe wavered in between parties, or people that have been independent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really where I feel that most of that is coming from. But I do want to say to that woman's comment, and this is something I have heard nationally when I travel around the state, you know, just in my groups of friends and people that I'm connected with, it's very dangerous to if people feel, you know, negative towards President Trump, to assign negative feelings to people that support him.
Mm.
Because it doesn't mean if someone disagrees with you, you know, if person A does not support the president, but person B does, it doesn't mean person B is a bad person.
I agree with that.
That's actually like the classic case definition of, in a sense, racism. You assign a motivation to an entire group of people because of one thing, and that's very dangerous for our country, and that's what actually concerns me most about the anti-Trump rhetoric out there, because that's exactly what our country's trying to move away from. And myself, as an adopted Korean woman, I take high offense when people come at myself or people that I know and have become friends with in the party because we support the president.
Russell, Jennifer's put her finger here on something that I have to say I struggle with, too, on this show, because I'm doing a talk show and people are calling in and tweeting in. The demonization of and the motives that people attach who were supporters of President Trump, I think that's just an indication of how deep the fissure and the polarization is in the country. But I wonder if you encounter that when you're talking to voters.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think it's exactly what you said. It just highlights how intense the feelings are. There are a lot of people in this country who feel the president is deeply immoral. They think that this is an unprecedented time in American history based on what some of the things that they are seeing from him, not only with the policies, for example, the family separations that we're seeing on the border right now, but also his personal history, that some people cannot get over that this is a man who's in the campaign seemed to be admitting to sexual assault and that kind of thing. And for people, particularly Democrats, some independents, that is a line in the sand, and they cannot see, just as this woman that you had on, they cannot see how anybody who has a conscience could support the president. But, of course, on the other side, you have very different feelings. And so, yeah, as you said, the fissure is just much deeper than it was under, you know, President Obama. And certainly there was a very deep polarization there as well.
Yeah, the measure of the intensity, I think, is deepened, as you said. Ann in Duluth says, I'm a strong independent. I'm here to welcome our president. He's an imperfect man with a perfect plan. The economy is booming. We're talking to our enemies. I want to see all people heal. To Dala in Chaska. Hi, Dala. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Tell me a little bit about yourself. You're 18?
Yeah, I'm 18. I've been interested in politics basically when Trump actually got into politics.
Okay.
I think the nature of him just being as a political candidate kind of got me interested, as I said, in politics. And as I said before, that's when I started looking at like foreign policy, because that's what I'm kind of doing in college.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
that's what I'm very interested in, especially.
Do I hear this right, that you approve of his foreign policy moves, doctrine so far?
Yes, I kind of do. I feel that the way that the establishment thinking is that we don't have to disagree with our allies, like a lot of it, because for a lot of all that, I agree with when he talks about dairy, how the Canadian like companies and the industry, mm-hmm, is very protective of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that either way, either you get tough with them or negotiate with them respectfully, in order to bring those type of tariffs down.
Okay. I appreciate the call. Hey, Jennifer, knowing that you have to run here in a couple minutes, what do you want to hear from the president tonight in Duluth about this immigration situation? He's saying he's going to sign something, quote unquote, to keep families together. What do you want to hear him say?
I think it's really going to be up to Congress and them putting forth bills that you know, can change our immigration in a positive way for the country. And so, you know, I would expect that he'd touch upon that a little bit tonight.
But do you want to hear the president say, I'm going to solve this immediate issue of separating parents from their children? Or are you fine with letting the continued debate around a bigger immigration bill go on?
You know, I think there's a larger discussion around immigration that needs to happen. And so, you know, this sort of one portion of it, which has, you know, made national headlines, you know, they're trying to work through. And so I'm hopeful that we'll hear about that tonight.
Do you feel like the president is feeling the pressure to solve this most urgent situation here, the separation issue? And do you think he ought to feel that pressure?
You know, I don't know, because I don't work in his administration, so I couldn't propose to guess how he feels about things.
But
I know that the president is very strong on immigration, and he said this when he was campaigning for president. He wanted to build a wall. He wanted to protect the borders and the country. And basically, what he's doing is just implementing and standing behind a law that's already been in place, especially there were past presidents that were there when this was in place. And so he's encouraging Congress to try to work things out. And I think that's positive, that he's encouraging the leaders in our country to try to look at legislation and make positive change for America.
Okay, so I don't think I phrased that very well. One more time. Do you believe that the president, as a GOP chair, here in Minnesota, that the president ought to feel urgency to resolve this issue with the separation of families. First and foremost, should he get to that?
You know, I think they're working on solving it. I mean, in my position as chair, just to be quite honest, my responsibility is to lead the strategy, the political strategy for the state of Minnesota and elect Republicans. I'm not a policymaker. If I was, I would have run for, you know, an elected position. So my job is to support our strategy and efforts and to stand behind our president and everything that our leaders do out in Washington, D.C.
Okay. Good luck with the rally tonight, and I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer Carnahan is the Minnesota GOP state chair. Russell Berman continues with us. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. He covers politics, and he's in McAllen, Texas, reporting on border issues. I want to also ask you, Russell, that the president is saying he will sign, quote unquote, something to keep families together. That the comments come amid news that Secretary Nielsen, Homeland Security Secretary, has been working on some kind of executive action. Do you think the president and the administration are feeling the heat of this controversy?
Yes, I do. I mean, whether they want to admit it or not, the president actually, I think, did admit it when he spoke to House Republicans yesterday at the Capitol, and was, you know, according to my colleague Elena Plott, who was there, he was saying that it's, you know, a bad look, and he was acknowledging the sort of awful images that are coming out of South Texas, for example. You know, we'll have to see what this executive order or whatever he is going to sign. The reality is, despite, you know, his efforts to blame the current law, this policy stems from a choice that the administration made to change its prosecutorial discretion, essentially, to this zero-tolerance policy. They made that decision in early April to essentially prosecute everybody who comes over the border illegally, and the family separation flows from that. So it's not really accurate to say it's the law and they have to enforce the law.
Right. I'm glad you emphasize that. Again, we did a lengthy segment yesterday in which we talked about how administrations prioritize. They have discretion to do that within immigration and obviously a lot of other policies. And when the president says it's all up to the Democrats in Congress, he's ignoring the possibility that he has to reprioritize, choosing not to do it, I guess.
Right. It's the equivalent of in your local town, if the police arrested or detained everybody who jaywalks, you know, the police departments, the law enforcement agencies in this country have always made decisions about what to prioritize in terms of enforcement, knowing that they do not have the resources to prosecute every single crime. And so traditionally on the border, that's what they've done. It's not that these people have faced zero punishment. Most of them have been deported without criminal prosecution. So if they're caught going over the border, they're processed for deportation. They're just not charged with a crime. And we're seeing right now how this policy not only is leading to the family separations, but it's really straining the federal court system. And you're seeing these mass trials that are going on, for example, in McAllen.
A show today that takes note of the president's arrival in Minnesota later today, holding a rally and some conversations in Duluth. And we're asking about how Republicans and independents feel about the remaking of the party in President Trump's image. He is the party and the party is him. And we're asking how you feel about that, especially I'm thinking about younger Republicans. Maybe this is the first Republican president that you voted for, or independents, young independents. How does this sit with you? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at @CarrieMPR, where someone who tweets as Duluth at heart, that's where the rally is. I passed two Trump supporters on my way to work today. As I stepped aside to let them pass together on a narrow sidewalk, I had to remind myself they love our country too. And then I wished them a good day. John says, all I hear today is Republicans saying the economy is going well, so let's excuse everything else Trump is doing. This is a horrible rationale. To the phones to Tyler in Minneapolis. And Tyler, thanks so much for waiting. I'm glad you did.
Hey, no problem, Carrie. How are you?
Doing well. So what are you thinking about this question that I'm putting out there about the party's identity and the president?
Well, yeah, for me, I think that those new demographic shifts have been particularly interesting. Myself, I'm a union apprentice, and talking with some of the older journeymen, those guys were all very strictly Democrat. They would vote Democrat in every single election. They would turn out. They would donate. I mean, it was a very active base. And I think that those don't hold true anymore. Mm-hmm. There's been, since about the 90s, I think, a transition away from wholeheartedly supporting the Democratic Party and their support of prevailing wage. Those arguments aren't holding as much weight. I think particularly just my own speculation is that it could be a result of identity politics and refuting the, if you will, PC culture that the right likes to attribute to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And coupling that with the perception of, like I had said, the neoliberalism and liberal elitism, and sort of rejecting and refuting those platforms.
Tyler, this is interesting because, Russell, I think we're going to hear from some people who were Bernie Sanders supporters who moved to Trump. We always do when we do shows like this. And so Tyler's argument is Trump didn't so much win them as the Democrats lost them. Is there something to that?
Yes, I think there is. I think the Democrats, one, you're seeing a lot of the cultural issues motivate or animate Trump supporters. And in turn, he has been playing them up, throughout his presidency with the, emphasizing the NFL protests or immigration policy. As the caller mentioned, what the conservatives refer to as sort of like exploiting this backlash against identity politics. And so I think you see that in Democrats as well, where there's a feeling that the Democrats had power and they didn't really focus like a laser on some of these bread and butter pocketbook issues, economic issues. And so then they get blamed for the economic malaise that the country went through, whether that's fair or not. Mm-hmm. And now you see the economy doing well and you see a Republican president and that may redound to Trump's benefit.
It's been interesting to see how the Republican establishment responds to this. I was watching something that Bill Kristol tweeted, I think it was last Wednesday after the primaries. Here's the tweet. And of course, he's somebody deeply into the establishment, a commentator and thinker. Corey Stewart wins in Virginia. Steve King retweets a neo-Nazi. Paul Ryan undercuts a DACA solution. Mitch McConnell won't defend free trade. Donald Trump trumpets a North Korea policy of amoral weakness. It's worth fighting for the GOP, but for now, it's getting worse, not better. What are people like Bill Kristol missing, I guess, about where this party is going under the president?
Well, I think one aspect of this that is really key is it's exposed this disconnect between the people who have been leading the Republican Party for many years in Washington and the actual rank and file voters and the issues they care about. For example, look at Paul Ryan. He was seen as this rising star. He was the policy guy.
Yeah.
He was the author of these really far-reaching cuts to Medicare and Medicaid, tax cuts. It turns out that that's not really why Republican voters, by and large, were voting Republican. They just assumed because they were winning, at least in the congressional level, that their voters supported these policies, these economic policies. But it was probably really about other issues. It may have been about immigration. It may have been about racial or ethnic identity issues. I mean, we have to acknowledge that there does seem to be an element of racism, at least among some supporters of the president. You look at the example that Bill Kristol gave of Corey Stewart, his victory in Virginia. He's really played up the Confederate flag issue.
That's right.
In his
Steve
campaign
King,
there.
Too.
And Steve King, of course.
Oh.
And this really, this really aggressive, hardline approach to immigration. And so, you know, and another example is, look, after 2012, Paul Ryan was on the ticket with Mitt Romney. The RNC, the Republican National Committee, came out with this plan. We need to moderate on immigration. That was their conclusion from the election. And 4 years later, the country and the Republicans elect a president who has gone in the opposite direction on immigration. And so I think that sort of highlights that disconnect between what the people in Washington were thinking about, what the voters were saying, and what the voters were actually thinking and saying themselves.
Russell Berman with us from The Atlantic covers politics in McAllen, Texas today, reporting on border and immigration issues and giving us the perspective, the larger national perspective, on how President Trump is seen within the party and reshaping the identity of the party, which is something that I'm asking you about. As a Republican, as a young Republican or an independent, how comfortable are you with this, whether you supported the president as a candidate or not? And Democrats, is there some opportunity or some risk for your party here? You know, we're hearing a lot about the blue wave, but the numbers shift. So I'll take a couple calls on that as well. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR. To the phones, to John in St. Cloud. Hey, John, thanks for waiting.
Hi. Hi there.
Tell me about yourself.
Yeah, I live in St. Cloud, Minnesota. I'm a professional. I've been mostly, I'm an independent, but I've been mostly a Democrat most of my life.
Uh-huh.
And a big Bernie supporter in the last election.
Okay.
And I did turn and vote for Trump. So did a little bit of a shift there.
Yeah, how did
but I do?
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, the reason for my shift was I am really kind of frustrated with the Washington, D.C. politics, the enormous amount of special interests, the fact that nothing ever changes. And even though I was supporting Bernie because of that needed change, Bernie was sidetracked by Democratic politics, by the Clinton infrastructure, which really, really frustrated me. And though Trump might not be perfect, he is an agent of change.
Okay.
And there's a lot of his policies that I do agree with. And I do believe that if the Republican Party really wants to go forward, they better follow a lot of the new ideas that Trump brings to the party. Otherwise, if you go towards the Paul Ryan, you know, Republican Party, it's going to be a failed party, I think.
Thanks for the call, John. Russell, I always wonder if this, if these, you know, Bernie become Trump voters really exist, and then we do a show like this and they call in. Are there more of them than I think, and how do you explain it?
Well, here's how I explain it. So if you remember from the old James Carville slogan from the Clinton campaign in 1992, it's about the economy,
yeah,
stupid.
Yes.
I think now it's about change, stupid.
Uh-huh.
Because if you look at the other dynamic here is you had all of these people in Minnesota, in Ohio, and Wisconsin who voted for Obama perhaps twice and then voted for Trump. And people are like, well, how could you do that? The running thread there is that Obama was the change candidate in 2008 against Hillary Clinton, who even back then was the establishment candidate. And Trump was the change candidate against Hillary Clinton again.
Mm-hmm.
Bernie Sanders was the change candidate in the primary against Hillary Clinton. And so I think you have this building up of just this visceral anger and frustration at Washington and a failure to address whatever policies that people, individuals think are the most important ones, this, you know, gridlock that they see, the partisan fighting, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that Trump got the votes of the people who were just really liked the idea of somebody shaking things up. They don't like Washington. And so if he's going to hurt some feelings there, that's fine. And I think that's where he actually has been, you know, most successful in the sense, if you look at what's going on with North Korea, the idea of just because this is the way we've done it before, means that this is the way we should do it in the future. He's totally bucked that on a lot of issues. And I think he's getting some support for people from people who are saying, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, we've been trying the same thing over and over again, and it hasn't worked. So why don't we try something new, even if it's not what the diplomats and the experts and everybody say has to be the way that it has to be done.
You know what's interesting about what you just described there is these are people who probably feel pretty cynical about government, right? The people that we've been doing this forever, nothing ever changes, can't stand Washington. And I think in some ways Bernie Sanders spoke to that cynicism. I mean, you know, I think we tend to think of him as an idealist, but he also spoke to that cynicism in a way that Donald Trump did, too, with his everything's rigged.
Right.
I mean, Sanders used that language sometimes, too.
And I think Sanders especially got support from people who actually cared about specific economic policies. Mm. And then it was a sort of a decision when he was no longer in the race. Well, do we care more about those specific economic policies that clearly Hillary Clinton probably would have been closer to, or do we care mostly about change for the sake of change? And at least in some of these states, change for the sake of change prevailed.
Yeah. Call here from Reed in St. Paul. Hi, Reed. You're going to give me the Democrats' view. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, I am. I live in St. Paul, and I think that, you know, the winds of change are really here. Most people are pretty disgusted on both sides with hyperpartisanism, and they don't necessarily believe politicians in general. And when politicians are running, they're choosing pretty extreme partisan-based ideologies that don't resonate with the majority of the people who are out there that are eligible to vote.
Uh-huh.
So 50% of real voters are independents, 25, 26 are Democrats, 24 are Republicans, but 40% of the people just stay home.
And yeah, but, you I'm know, actually, a lot of those independents lean a certain way, Reed, and often, you know, vote the way they lean. I don't know if they're true independents. What were you going to say?
On values. And so people are, whether they're Democratic or Republican, there is a kind of a common theme of family values. And whether if they're religious, most of the people that I know that are religious and Republican are more about love and inclusion rather than hate and exclusion. And, you know, it's an opening for Democrats, so much so that I even decided to run for Congress for the U.S. House of Representatives, because I don't think that our partisan placeholder representatives are actually representing the values that most of us voters really care about.
All right. Let me go back to Russell on this idea of the opening for Democrats. So what's the calculation, Russell, that you think Democrats are making?
Well, I mean, I think they're just looking at the plain numbers. The president is still opposed by a majority of people in this country. There seems to be a lot of energy on their side of, you know, sort of people who are angry. And I think they're trying to tap into that. We haven't seen a ton of specifics. I think they are trying to basically run against Trump and the Republicans, and I think that'll be enough. It'll be interesting to see if they come out with a more cohesive economic plan, for example, or even something that's new. I think, you know, one challenge for the Democrats is how to tap into these people who want change, who don't feel that Trump has brought the change that they thought they were voting for. But, you know, the Democrats, they're still having a debate about whether Nancy Pelosi, for example, should be the leader of the party in the House. She's been around for a long time. They're still having a debate about, well, do we embrace something like Medicare for All, as a party, something that's more liberal than the Affordable Care Act, something closer to what Bernie Sanders was. They're still trying to sort all of that out. And I think the risk for them is they sort of wind up in the middle. They wind up, you know, trying to say, well, we're going to change things, but at the same time, we're going to keep the same leaders that we've had, and we're not really going to change the economic platform that we've put forward for the last decade or so.
I was reading somewhere last week that President Obama has been meeting with a number of the would-be presidential candidates for 2020. What's your guess about what he's saying about the way you just laid this out?
I would guess that he would say that you need to put something, the Democrats need to put forward something that people can vote for. They need to get people excited about the possibilities of democratic governance. And if you even look at Hillary Clinton's book, sort of her reflections on her campaign, one of the few regrets I think that she said is she did want to go bolder on some of these newer economic policies, something to rally people around. You know, Trump, you can make fun of it all you want, but he did have a couple of very clear things that he was going to do, and he was going to build the wall, for example, and even trade. He was more clear about what he was going to do, if a little bit simplistic, than what Hillary Clinton had been saying. And so there, she talks about, well, you know, she considered calling for a universal basic income for people, which would have been a really jolting type of economic idea from a national leader. It's something that's bubbled up on the left a little bit over the last few years, but that would have been something that would have gotten her a lot of attention. It would have taken the attention off of Trump. It would have been in line with the policies that Bernie Sanders was really getting people excited about.
Right.
And instead, she went in a different direction, and she kind of played it safe. And, you know, she tried to just go after Trump more than anything else. And she won the popular vote, but not the electoral vote. We know how that turned out.
Misreading where the electorate was, as so many people did.
Right.
Nick in Minneapolis called to say, I'm 30. I wanted to talk about the idea that the Republican Party has become the party of Trump. They've hitched their star to one person. He's not going to be in office forever. Are Republican leaders thinking about what happens to the party after this? Russell, it's a good question. Are they?
I think that is the question for the long term. I mean, one thing we do not know is if we've we can pretty clearly say, as you have throughout this show, that right now, in this moment, the Republican Party is the party of Trump. But what we don't know is what happens. Is this a permanent thing, or is this just a temporary phase? I mean, look at his vice president, Mike Pence, who would be a presumptive heir, as vice presidents usually are. Well, Mike Pence was a representative of the old Republican Party. He was a free trader. He was more compassionate, you might say, on immigration. And he was a fiscally very conservative in terms of much lower spending than Trump has embraced. Now, of course, Mike Pence has stayed very close to Trump. He has not criticized him at all as vice president. So even just to look at where does Mike Pence go and what, you know, in the whether it's the second term or if a Democrat wins, whether it's after 2020, that will be interesting to see. So the short answer is we don't know.
And I do want to say this. CNN is now reporting that the president is saying he will sign an executive order to keep families together, presumably that executive order that Secretary Nielsen was working on. What any sense, Russell, since you're in McAllen, Texas, what that'll mean?
Not until we see the specifics.
Yeah.
I think certainly people will embrace anything that even temporarily stops this policy of separating the families. But we're also seeing that maybe it's they're going to try to have it both ways, where they keep the zero tolerance policy but don't separate the families. There's been some talk that whatever Trump signs could provoke a legal challenge because of the sort of specific reading of the law. We'll need to wait for the specifics on it. But certainly if it at least temporarily stops the separations, then people will be happy with that.
And Russell, another question about that. Does that also then stop what seemed to be some urgency towards coming back and debating immigration, a larger package? Does that also kind of take the heat away from that?
It's unclear because we've seen there within the larger package that they are debating right now in the House, there is language that would stop the family separations. There is also a push to pass a narrow piece of legislation and not allow this issue to get caught up in the DACA debate, for example. I think the president, if and when he signs this, he will say that Congress should still legislate it permanently, especially if there is going to be a legal challenge to whatever he signs. But what we've seen from Congress is, especially with this DACA situation, unless there is a hard deadline with consequences, there is no consensus on any immigration legislation. And so I think if he takes away even the urgency of the immediate need to stop the family separations, that could decrease momentum for any of this any of these proposals.
I just want to say this: he doesn't need an executive order to stop this. He could stop it right now without an order.
Exactly. This is, again, it all stems from the decision that was made 2 months ago on zero tolerance, and prosecutorial discretion. So yes, you're right. Congress does not need to pass a law to change the family separations. But of course, if Congress were to pass a law, that could help.
Okay. Hey, Russell, thanks so much. I really appreciate you doing this from McAllen, Texas, and talking to us about, you know, developing news and then the larger issues. Thank you very much.
Sure thing. It was a great conversation.
Coming back now to Duluth, to Minnesota, and Mark Zdechlik. He's in Duluth covering the president's rally, which is going to be held tonight, and we'll have live coverage of that. Mark, what do the preparations look like up there?
Well, they look like they're getting ready, Kerry, for a big rally. There's big American flags around, a lot of reporters getting set up, and technical people putting gates and crowd kind of control type stuff up. The arena here, Kerry, has capacity for 8,500 people. That's what security people tell us. We don't know how many people will actually be here later today. Interesting, Kerry, they were doing some sound check stuff, and they played part of a pre-recorded message that will be telling attendees to the rally that if there are people in the arena to protest Donald Trump, that they should in no way involve themselves beyond flagging down security. They're very specific that don't touch anybody or anything like that. So they're trying to head off any problems that have accompanied other Trump rallies.
Yeah, Mark, that is interesting because that happened during when the president was running for president. That happened at a number of rallies where people in the crowd were confronting one another. Are they going to have a lot of security? Can you tell?
Oh, I'm sure there's going to be massive security. There's security anytime the president does anything. And they're obviously aware of protesters. They have an area outside of this Amsoil Arena, which is part of the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center, that is what they're calling a safe area for protesters and people who are not fans of Trump to gather. And around town, Kerry, this morning, you do see people with signs. I was staying near a street corner where there was a makeshift kiosk set up selling Trump merchandise, and that attracted Trump opponents who very peacefully just held signs around it to try to get their message out. It's definitely the case that not everybody is here to celebrate President Trump.
Mark, remind me about the political landscape that he's coming into, because as was noted by the DFL chair today, the president did not win Minnesota, but he got a lot of votes, including and in the area and near the area in which you're waiting to cover the rally, yes?
Absolutely. And it's important to point out, too, he came very close to winning Minnesota. He lost by less than 50,000 votes to Hillary Clinton. Up here in the 8th District, the 8th Congressional District, he won by almost 16 percentage points. And Trump supporters, who I've been speaking with throughout the midterm election here, have said that they think he's more popular now than he was in 2016. They're very happy about the steel tariffs and that kind of thing. So he's coming into a supportive part of the country right now.
And Mark, I know you've just kind of arrived and gotten the lay of the land. When you talk to people, are you going to be asking them about this immigration issue? Because the president is making news now in Washington. Presumably, he's going to talk about that from the stage of the rally.
I would assume he will be, and I certainly will be talking to people about that. It'll be interesting to see what the hardcore fans think. Is this something they really wanted him to do? Was it important to them? That kind of thing. And hopefully we'll get some of that in the reporting down the road here.
One last question here. I know, and I was asking Jennifer Carnahan about this earlier, that there are Republican politicians, Tim Pawlenty among them, who are trying to figure out whether they're going to be. Pawlenty is saying he doesn't know if his schedule is going to allow for him to be there, who have to make a decision about whether they want a photograph, right, or videotape of them on the stage with the president. Are you noting anything on that?
Well, it's interesting. This is not the first time this has come up. This happens all the time in elections. But some members of Congress are too busy to make it to this event, and others are finding a way to work
or
it into
so
their schedule.
Say.
You
yeah.
read the tea leaves on that.
All right. Mark, thanks very much. Appreciate the lay of the land up there.
Absolutely.
Mark Zdechly with us from Duluth, where he's at the arena in which President Trump will hold a rally. Later this evening, you'll hear live coverage of the president's remarks on NPR News, and then you will hear perspective on the remarks and some fact-checking on the remarks that the president will make in Duluth. You can hear our coverage, this conversation I just had about where President Trump is going with the Republican Party. If you missed the discussion, find it on the podcast, the book show, the summer book list that I did at 9 o'clock. All of our shows, including my conversations with the political junkie, right there on the podcast. Search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you listen.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.